Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meat in 3, we're embracing the spooky spirit of Halloween, from zombies to witches. We're exploring the odd, the occult, and the taboo in the world of food.
There are restaurants with no storefront, shrunken down into hundreds of square feet versus thousands of square feet. No servers, no hosts, nobody taking your order.
The rats in the sewers are now smelling, all of a sudden, fresh food molecules. And those rats were like, holy cow, follow that scent.
Tune in to Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
So welcome to the show, Raheem. It's great to have you on. As I mentioned to you earlier, you are the final and therefore the most special guest of the of this season. I'm really thrilled to talk to you and, you know, share your story and your journey with the rest of the world. I'm sure a lot of people in New York and then just based on the press you've done know your story, but I think it would be helpful for the wider audience. We have a huge audience on the continent, and then just from people across the country in the US and in Canada, I think would benefit from learning from your story, which I've always found fascinating. So
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, cool. So for those that don't know you, what do you want to share about who you are? And you can tell us about your brother too, because he's not here to speak for himself, so you can say
I know, right? I'll introduce him very briefly, but I don't think I will do justice to him introducing himself, so I'll announce him, but I won't go into any detail, you know. He's my brother, we're very, very close, but still, everyone's, you know, likes to present themselves in a very specific way, and I don't want to violate that, you know.
Right.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having us on here. When I heard you're doing this podcast, I was very excited about it. And specifically, an African food podcast, I always felt like the media component in African food and beverages, going into the mainstream was lacking, right? And so when I stumbled upon this, when I got your email, which I was very, very late to reply to, I just loved the whole idea, and the context within which we met back in the Dining on the Mat series, I just loved the production level of that event that I felt like you would I look good talking to you on any platform, you know. So thank you for having me.
That's great.
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder of Jinjam Brothers. My brother is the other half, my brother Mohammed, and really our goal with Jinjam Brothers is to develop and bring to market food and beverage products inspired by traditional African recipes. And you know, we started out with Jinjang, a classic ginger-based beverage that you find throughout West Africa, made with fresh ginger, pineapples, lemon, vanilla, and anise. But really, our goal is not to stop there, right? It's to take everything from other beverages like jinjang and other snacks and, you know, traditional grains and dishes and stews, all these things that we of the continent know are there and are amazing. And if the rest of the world was to get a chance to get exposed to it, they would absolutely embrace it and really bring it to market in a way that would give and do justice to the people and the culture within which these products evolved. So that's the overall mission.
Yeah, you summarized it quite nicely, and there's a lot to unpack in that summary that we will cover throughout our conversation today. But I wanted to take us maybe, I don't know how many years back that would be, but just how and when did you guys end up in the States? Because a lot of African immigrants that I speak to have, you know, their own interest, including myself, have their own interesting ways of, one, how they ended up here. Two, they probably started in a quote-unquote traditional job or role and then sort of found themselves in this food space, not just for the business aspect of it, but there's also like that, you know, story to you, that authentic storytelling piece, you know, like wanting to share aspects of ourselves. So if we go back, you tell me how many years ago, I don't know how many years ago that was, but how you landed here. And then even as you spoke about, you know what you want to do with Ginger in terms of not just the drink, but eventually snacks and whatnot, it made me think about the fact that you guys are guys, right? And when I think about how I grew up cooking very early on. And I think of my younger brother now who was not immersed as much in the kitchen as my sister and I were, right? So I also wonder what that connection is for you in terms of kitchen experience and then coming into this.
Sure. So I'll touch on when we got here first, and then maybe go right, and then go back to the somewhat beginning and tie in, you know, how the, like you said, males in Africa traditionally aren't really, you don't really catch them much in the kitchen unless they're hungry, you know? and I was hungry a lot, so maybe that has something to do with it. so yeah, my brother came to the States before I did. He came in 97. He was 13, going on 14 years old. He, you know, he stayed with friends of the family. I mean, like you said, our immigrant story, that we, if you were to like unpack that portion of it, we'll spend a whole hour only talking about that. So I'm only going to brush
over it. Yeah, it's fine. And I think because you guys do a lot of press, I can link up to some, for people that want to know the full story, I can link to some other press that shares it. Because ultimately, I want to touch on it so people have a sense or a flavor of it, but what our goal for the conversation ultimately is to help, one, because we have a lot of small food business owners that listen to this, so want to delve more into your operations versus
exactly. It's a podcast about Africa, about food, specifically African food, so that's what we're going to spend the bulk of the time talking about. So yeah, my brother came in 97, around 13. He stayed with friends of the family in Pennsylvania and then moved down to Atlanta with another friend of the family. Ended up coming back to New York briefly and graduated high school in New Hampshire. So I came to see his graduation. I came in 2001, around 2001. I was 14, about a month or so before I turned 15. And initially I was just coming on vacation. And the plan was for me to stay for the summer, go back home, finish high school there, and I probably would have ended up in France for college or Canada or something like that. But I ended up staying because after the summer I was learning English, and we just figured that it's a good idea for me to stay here. And since I was somewhat young and learned the culture and just have an easier time as I grow older, adapting to the American culture and Western culture as a whole. So that's sort of how we got here. Then, you know, academically, fast forward a few years later, my brother went to business, well, he studied business in undergrad. I don't want to say he went to business school and people think an MBA. He did business administration in undergrad, and I did engineering for undergrad and grad school. I did engineering undergrad at Michigan State, grad school in Germany and France. And my brother did his undergrad. He started out at Polytech, NYU Polytech here, and finished up at Mercy. And the way we got into this food business, really, our goal early on, and this is something that any African that's been here any length of time would attest to, it's really just a general frustration of how we present it to the world, right? For one, if we present it at all, right? So it's just starting something that would allow us to present Africa in a better light. So we could have done this in fashion, in music, media, we just happened to do it in food, and for a number of reasons. Food is one of the principal aspects of any culture, right, that can be readily embraced by someone else with minimal effort. You know, unlike traveling or learning a new language, right, you can walk into a Ghanaian restaurant, a South African restaurant, without having ever, interacted with that culture before, right? Taste their food, learn their food, and really, if you fall in love with that, it opens up your curiosity to learn the culture further, right? So that's sort of why we picked food. And beyond that, if you think about the situation of traditional African foods in Africa, it's a massive market that's extremely fragmented, and there's yet to be really any significant brand behind that, right? You have an easier time getting, cases of namely imported brand or product than you do having some of the local stuff, which is mind-boggling.
And even in the fragmented market, I'm finding that, like, Chinese and Asian stores are also sort of taking hold, like, in terms of groceries or retail in some ways. Yep. They're taking over that space as well, which is frustrating.
You're right. Before them, it's the Lebanese, and in Western in Francophone countries, the French. If it's something more valuable, if in the Anglophone countries, maybe some of the Brits and something like that. But that's it. It's almost never us, commercializing our own stuff. So we feel like the African market, like the traditional beverage space in Africa, or not just beverage, food, beverage, like everything, CPG. Is so massive, right? And that if we build a brand here, and the only reason we started in the US is because one, we're in the US, and two, infrastructurally, it's easier to launch a business here than it is to launch a business in Africa, right? And we also felt that if we start a business here, we build it, we're of the continent, we understand the culture really well. If we take it from here, and then we go back to Africa, there'll be a sense of pride in our people in receiving it. And let's be honest, oftentimes the people, the businesses that are started on the continent by people of the continent aren't as readily embraced, right?
Right. But until they quote unquote make it elsewhere, which is
So if you bring your brand back there and it's like, hey, this is killing it in America or in France or in name the Western country, right? And you have white people are drinking this, or white people are eating this. All of a sudden, they'll embrace you a little more readily. I mean, that is not the primary reason, but these are all factors that played into us deciding, let's get this going here before anything else. As for spending any time in the kitchen or why we started the food product, not being cooks, for one thing, so we came here at a really relatively young age. So in some ways, we had to be independent. I mean, at least me, my brother is not a great cook, but I cook a lot, right? Because by the time I got to college, even when I was in high school, I used to cook for us at home. And when I was a kid back home in Guinea, I was a little fat kid. So I loved hanging out with my mom in the kitchen, right? because you know, I'd be in the kitchen. I would help her cut the meat or do something like that, just so I have first dibs when the food is ready. You know what I mean? And I just generally loved hanging out with my mom, mm-hmm. so there was that exposure. This doesn't mean that I knew how to cook whatsoever, but you know, I had an affinity for, you know, I didn't grow up with this mindset and of men don't spend time in the kitchen, and my dad also wasn't like that. My dad was pretty progressive in that sense. Mm-hmm. So all of that played into it. Plus, here I spent about, you know, I essentially paid my way through college waiting tables in the U.S.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I waited tables, I attended bar, I managed a bar, so I have a lot of experience in the hospitality space. Everything from little mom and pop shops to like Michelin star restaurants in New York City.
Cool. So actually, even before we go ahead, I think it might be helpful to explain what ginger means. Like, I don't know if it has any specific meaning in a language. It sounds like ginger. So I don't know if it's a play on the word ginger or if it's, I don't know. You tell us.
Another language.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ginger, the ginger-based drink, right, that we make in Guinea, is called ginger. Now,
okay.
Now, it doesn't mean none of the languages in Guinea, it doesn't mean ginger in any of the languages in Guinea. It's a specific name for the liquid beverage, that specific liquid beverage. And for example, ginger in my native language, Fulani, is Nyamakuledi.
Oh.
It means pepper of the earth. And so if you were to go to places like Ivory Coast or Mali, you know, where you have more of the Mandingo speakers, they're calling Yamakuji, right? Same thing.
Oh, so that wouldn't easily roll off the tongue for us.
Not as easily. So it's a total coincidence that ginger sounds like ginger.
Yeah.
And it just made sense to use it.
Yeah, that's good branding. So I wanted to talk about your cafe in Harlem. Because we'll delve into the business of the drink itself after the break. But I wanted to talk specifically about the cafe. Like, why a cafe? So you've done, I don't know if it was always in the plan, but you've done, you know, the beverage, it's doing fairly well. Why did you want to settle yourselves with the brick and mortar store? And then why Harlem specifically too?
So the strategy from this was part of the strategy from the very beginning. The way we see this evolving and is, you know, the plan with the cafes is to have them, you know, have a number of them in major metro areas. So imagine like a few of these in New York City, places like, you know, DC, Atlanta, Houston, Seattle, London, you name it, right? Like major metropolitan areas, is to have the cafes in those locations. And the reason why we felt that a cafe had to be part of the you know, the strategy is that, you know, we're trying to sell African culture. We're trying to, you know, demystify the products, cultures, and people of Africa, right? And it's hard to accomplish that with just a packaged product, because there's only so much you can communicate on a bottle, on a label, on a bottle. So the cafes, when you walk into them, you know, from the decor to the music to the flavors, right? It's meant to give you this, you know, experience, like you know, like this experience of African culture in a way that you could not get with just interacting with a label. So that's really the idea. You walk in there, you're sitting in there, you might walk in and just get a latte and not get one of our specialty beverages, right? So we not just ginger, but we right now we already have our next, the next three SKUs that we roll out. The hibiscus-based drink, we call it Bisap. There's like two teas. One is a Moroccan mentee called Latai, and the other one is a Kenkeliba. It's this like hardy bush that grows on marginal lands throughout West Africa. That's amazing in terms of its health benefits that we're also selling there. So the cafe allows us to not only feature some of those products on there and use it as a testing ground for some of those products before we shift them into like a packaged drink that we're distributing through either direct to consumer online or through using third party retailers.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN can provide a virtual table we can all gather around, bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new shows.
We had to cut off our first half of our conversation, our first third of our conversation, actually, with Raheem, because Seattle had a brief power outage. And so these things that you expect in Africa happen right here. And actually, Seattle is a big tech hub now, right, too. So it's interesting that it would happen here with all of our high tech stuff. And then we were just shut off. But the good thing about it is that we are now joined by the other half of Gingin Brothers.
Yes.
Which is great. So things always happen the way they're supposed to in that sense. So we're glad to have you on, Mohammed. Maybe do you want to introduce yourself a little bit before we jump back into where we were at in the interview?
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. My name is Mohammed Diallo. I'm the other half of Gingin Bros. The skinnier looking older brother. that's really it. I think I'll keep it brief, and people will get to know more as we speak, I think.
Sure, cool. So when we spoke with Raheem last time, we talked a little bit about how you guys came to the US, your early memories of food and cooking, and what brought you to starting the Gingin brand of drinks. But before going into the specifics of that business, I wanted you guys to tell us why you decided to saddle yourselves with a brick and mortar store, why you chose to have a cafe, why you chose to have it in Harlem in particular. What is the thought process behind that?
Yeah, we've been asking ourselves that same question lately. the brick and mortar has always been in the equation, to be honest with you. The plan was initially, you know, once we put together this amazing business, we raise hundreds of millions of dollars, we grow the business all over the country. A few years in, we would get the cafes going. We would open a cafe here and there and expand at that point. But what we realize is the reality is quite different in terms of getting funding for, you know, people with our background. You know, we don't necessarily, we don't have the ideal profile, let's say, for what investors, CPGs, VCs necessarily look for in the initial phase. So we have to make sure that we can prove to them that we are the real deal, that we can do and we can deliver upon what we're promising them. So from the packaging goods side of things, we managed to do that really well with the one drink. But the challenge was still, getting that that image or sort of selling them on what the larger, the bigger picture. You know, they didn't understand beyond what they saw and they tried, which was simply the ginger drink. What we're trying to achieve is a full CPG company that also had hospitality embedded in it, you know, a brand that can be I can house all these different amazing products from back home, essentially. When, you know, because we weren't able to convey that message thoroughly, we decided, you know, perhaps if you do, even with the ginger drink, people didn't quite get it until they saw it and they tried it and they tasted it. But perhaps if you'd give something more comprehensive, something like a space people can come into and get immersed into the culture, listen to the music, the smell, the taste, the sound, try these other drinks like the Sorello, Zobo, Isap, you know, try some of our food, like the grains and stuff that we have back home and the sauces. Perhaps the picture would be more vivid and clear. Quite frankly, it worked pretty well, you know, until we closed in March due to COVID. Yeah. And it was going amazingly well. We had rave reviews. People all of a sudden came in and they knew about all these other drinks that we were trying to serve. And when investors or other people that we're trying to talk to came in and spoke to us, we didn't have to say that much because they saw everything and they tried it and they believed in it. And, you know, it's nothing feels better than people walking in and say, yo, Starbucks got nothing on you guys. Like, this place is better than Starbucks. I would rather come in here than go anywhere else. So really it was just to show that we can execute at that level. We can have a space and a place and provide quality products that are that good and that excellent. You know, it's all about the quality of the product is very good, but also presentation is extremely important. And we were able to put all of that together with the cafe.
Yeah, and I agree. And I can speak firsthand because I've been to the cafe a couple of times. And I think like you said, there's a certain pride, at least for me, having sort of been in this space now for 5+ years. I look at a lot of brands for lack of a better term. And there's a certain pride when you walk into a space like that, that not only sort of captures your identity or tells your culture, your story in this, in a way that you recognize, but it's also done at a level that you can be proud of, that you can say, hey, like my friend from, you know, Italy or wherever, like I'm going to take you to this place that, you know, shows you a little bit more about who I am and where I'm from and all of that stuff. And I follow that. So the people that are telling you that this has got nothing on Starbucks, yes, there's that, but then also from a person that's African, there's that connection to it that
absolutely.
Yeah, that I think is hard to replicate. So kudos to you guys. And one of the things I wanted, even before you had the cafe, I think you may be underselling yourselves in terms of the story you're trying to tell and branding and your brand identity. I think it's pretty strong. I think you can, just by virtue of being on your website, on Instagram, on social, all of that. Did you have a particular, story that you wanted to tell? Or what's the overall vision in terms of the quote-unquote African story that you're trying to tell through your brand identity, whether it's through the interior design, through the logo design?
The story we're trying to communicate to the world really is that, you know, that the people of Africa, the people that come from the continent and the products that we have on the continent and really everything associated with Africa is a lot more than the narrative that folks outside of Africa have, you know, essentially have known all their whole lives, right? So typically you mention Africa to folks that don't know of the continent or are not really, that don't know as much about the world outside of wherever they come from. It tends to not be a positive image they get of Africa, mm-hmm. right? It's ideas of corruption, ideas of poverty. It's just, you know, this basket case of the continent that just needs people to come out from the outside and save them, right? And you think about, we had a lady, this has happened a number of occasions. We'll have people come into the coffee shop and ask, you know, when we tell them our beans, our drip coffee is a blend of beans from Africa, Congo, Rwanda, and Ethiopia, you'll have people that don't know that there's coffee in Africa, literally.
Right.
And, you know, whereas coffee comes from Africa, right?
Yeah.
I had a Colombian couple once come sit there, you know, you could tell they're tourists, they ordered coffee, they had their latte and a cappuccino, I believe it was. And they just loved it. So I come over to clear their plates. And she asked, the lady asked me, is this Colombian coffee? We're like, you know, you could tell Colombian.
Yeah.
I said, do you like it? She goes, yeah, it's amazing. And then I tell her it's not Colombian coffee. And I explained to her what the blend is.
Mm-hmm.
And she was surprised that there's coffee as good as whatever she perceives Colombian right. coffee to be, right? But that's not from coffee, it's from Colombia. And even more so that it's from Africa. Right, like she, this woman from Colombia takes pride in coffee, but doesn't know that these are beans that probably started their lives somewhere in East Africa. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
the transport there. So just generally changing that that view people have of Africa, and you know, we tell this to folks often. We could have done this in other spaces, in media and fashion, and you name it. It just so happens that food has a unique food. You know, you can embrace another culture through the food in a way that you cannot do anything else, right? It's harder to learn a language or to pack your bags and go and travel around Africa and get to learn Africa that way. But you can go to, if we had places like the Jinjiang Cafe, you know, throughout the world, you can have people go in there. And even if that doesn't necessarily completely change their mindset, their view of Africans, African Africans, it will at least have something else that's positive in their mind that they can associate with Africa beyond whatever preconceived notions they have, you know? So it's that, yeah, just essentially just highlighting the fact that we're capable of executing at the highest level, just like everyone else, and that our products should be, you know, everywhere, just like everyone else's products are in Africa. That's more or less.
Yeah.
That's a long-winded way of telling you, we just want to tell the story of Africa.
Yeah. I agree, and it even with the coffee. Oh, were you going to say something?
Yeah, it's Mohammed now. But if I may jump in quickly, one thing we did not want to compromise on was quality. We noticed that whenever we mentioned our products, and of course we too had frustration of going into certain markets and seeing the branding was a bit poor. But we realized one of the biggest difference between our products and other products out there in the market is really just a lack of an absence of branding or taking branding more seriously.
Mm.
So I say this because what we did is looks good and it even looks simple sometimes, but it really was quite difficult. We went through over 70 different designers get to what we wanted to have, simply because the stereotype is everywhere. They don't do it in purpose, but every designer, brand designer that we went to was giving us stuff like with like an African lady holding something on their head.
The souvenir shop.
You know,
designing a souvenir shop.
You know, like just everything stereotypical about Africa. Mm. Like that's the type. We were like, listen, perhaps we should tell you to forget about Africa as a whole. Just make the best possible looking brand that you can. And communicating even that was difficult the moment we mentioned Africa. So we really, really had to be extremely patient and just go through people and have the courage to say, no, sorry, you're close, but not quite there. No, thank you, thank you, thank you. So, you know, we just have to take ourselves also serious enough to know that, you know, if our qualities are of great product, and if we can just also make it look as good.
Thank you, Bintasi. Our products have a great quality.
Yeah. We have great quality products. Yeah, exactly. Great quality products. And if you can simply get the look, the brand, and take everything else that comes along with it more seriously, everyone else has no choice but to take us seriously, in essence. And I think that's how we will change the narrative of Africa from what we're doing here to what you're doing. What you're doing is also very high quality. So it's all of those things that needs to come together for Africa to be viewed in a slightly better light, or in the way that we know that it is or it can be.
Yeah. As you were just talking about the quality of your product, it made me start to think. I'm now going to transition into talking about the CPG, the food business, packaging business in particular, and how challenging it can be. One, starting just with regulations, right? So talking about quality reminds me of my brother actually started a juice business some time ago, but wasn't able to follow through with it for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that he found challenging was meeting like FDA standards for the things that, or the claims that were on the label, right? So if I remember correctly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't have the bottle in front of me. I think your drink is considered or labeled organic and GMO free, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's at least organic. So if people are thinking about entering, and a lot of people that are doing this want to enter into the space and are looking at juices specifically, are probably going to go that route because of the signal of quality of health. What are the, in terms of labeling and meeting regulations, what are some of the hurdles or what are some of the considerations people need to think about as they put together a product for?
So, you know, food is very heavily regulated. I mean, if you think about the fact that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, right? So it's regulated at the same level as drugs. Rightfully so. And depending on where you are, I mean, we're in the U.S., so we'll just focus on cases that are specific to the U.S. Each state has different regulatory bodies that you might fall under, right? So in New York, for example, we have to be inspected by the Department of Agriculture, and that's a state department. But if you're a brick and mortar location that's like the cafe, that has to be inspected by the Department of Health of the city of New York. So there's a local level that we have to deal with in New York City for the cafe. And then for the packaged goods, we have to, register with the FDA and then be inspected by the Department of Agriculture of the state of New York, right? So, and then you have the voluntary sort of regulatory stuff you have to comply with for, say, for any sort of, any claims. The non-GMO certifications, the organic certification. And it's not just applying for it and getting the pay, getting approved for the first time. It's an ongoing compliance burden, right? Because you get inspected annually, but you have to track all your, all the ingredients you use, everything. There's a very specific documentation you have to have in place that they can come in and audit once a year and, decide whether you can keep your certification or not, right? So that's really the main areas you have to deal with. The FDA is not a regulatory body per se, right? They don't come and inspect you, but you have to be registered with them just in case what recalls and things like that. And they issue guidance on regulation for the states and the local municipalities to take and enforce, right? So they will issue guidance on how to, say, police the juice business, and the Department of Agriculture at the state level will adapt, more often than not, adapt those recommendations, but they might take it and adjust it a little bit. And that's the body you're interfacing with as a brand to stay in compliance. Now, it's a lot of paperwork, but honestly,
I was gonna ask.
It's not impossible. And one thing I would share with, some of your audience, even if it's not just in the food space, really, one thing I've learned over the last, 6 years or so, is that most of what you're doing in your business is paperwork, right? It's sort of kind of intuitive. You'll think that it's a lot of the things you're getting up and doing, the making the product, but the most important aspects of your business will be paperwork related, whether you're complying with, financial regulation stuff or something specific regulations to your industry. But again, none of this is impossible. And if you're in the US, in the Western world in general, it's relatively straightforward because you can look it up. You know what I mean? You can Google it. Like I think folks doing this in Africa have a much tougher time. On one hand, regulation is not that strict, but on the other hand, you also don't have access to as many resources. I'm not even talking about money, but I'm talking more about data and information and just a supply network that would be around you, things like that.
And then, so you said you generally just look it up and do, but just by virtue of the volume of paperwork, not just with the food regulations, but everything else, do you ever outsource or have you thought about outsourcing some of that just to give you more flexibility with operations? Or do you do everything yourself?
As much, honestly, if you have someone you can outsource it to, if you can afford to outsource it, wherever you can hire someone that knows what they're doing better than you do, you know, as an entrepreneur, that's your job really, is to put those people in place. But in our case, we pretty much didn't outsource anything because we didn't have two things. One, we didn't have the, we couldn't afford it. You know, food consultants are very expensive. And two, since we couldn't afford it, we also, you know, we have the skill set to learn things like this and in a relatively short time and implement them just by virtue of our educational background. So I think, you know, most people that have had some sort of, that are comfortable with, you know, administrative work, you know, paperwork and, or that have a background in, really that have an, you know, advanced education of some kind ought to be able to do it themselves if they want to. But again, if you can afford it, can get someone that knows what they're doing better than you, hire someone and let them do it the time.
Yeah. And then I guess my last question around the food regulation piece before we move forward is around staying through to like the recipe, right? So if I recall, you know, you sort of had to call your mom to put the first original recipe together. But then in terms of, it's a perishable product, right? So in terms of, I'm sure there's, I don't know, regulations around, you know, keeping it shelf stable or whatever to make sure that it can last for X number of days. Does that affect like the authenticity? Like, do you have to change certain things so that it's not as maybe quote unquote authentic as you would like, or?
No, so the, in terms of the shelf stability of the product, it's up to you, you know, you have a lot of options in terms of how to extend the shelf life of your product.
Yeah.
As far as the regulatory bodies are concerned, they only care that whatever it is that you adopt is safe, right? Okay. So they only care about protecting the safety of the consumer. Now, you extend the shelf life mainly not because of a safety issue, but because business-wise, you cannot sell a product that expires in 3 days, right? You don't have enough time. So, you know, that's whatever option you choose to use as a shelf life extending method, whether it's using preservatives, whether it's using like heat to pasteurize it, whether it's some more novel techniques like high pressure processing, or you're using something like using ozone to sanitize it and extend the shelf life. Regardless of what you use, you have to make sure that it's either a method that's already been approved for your types of products. So for example, if you're doing a beverage that has a certain pH, you need to, in order for you to say use regular heat pasteurization techniques, there are standards where you have to hold that liquid at a certain temperature, I think it's around 160, for 30 seconds or longer, right? I forget the exact number, but it's around there. And that's guaranteed to kill whatever pathogenic agent that normally would survive in that sort of environment, right? And so on and so forth. So depending on what your pH is, what your ingredients are, whether you're using preservatives or not, you just need to make sure you're using things that are either already approved, that's on a list of approved compounds by the regulatory bodies, or you can go to say a lab, like in New York, you could go to Cornell University and they'll run some of these tests for you. They'll do a validation study, meaning they'll take it and run it through the process that you say you will use to produce your product and then test the shelf life of it and tell you, okay, this is a method that has been validated to kill like 5 logs of, you know, pathogenic compounds that would be in it. I'm getting a little technical.
No, but I think it's helpful. A lot of people don't get this level of detail as you think about it. They think, oh, I make the best, I don't know, watermelon juice. I'm going to try to do this. And then they run into some of these stumbling blocks. So I think it's helpful.
I think we are, you know, we did too, you know, I mean, going into it, you have no idea what to look out for. But again, once you know who's regulating you, you can literally reach out to the regulatory body, tell them exactly what you're doing, and you'll find them very helpful. And the shelf life, if you say, you know, this is something you can do beforehand, you can test the shelf life just roughly yourself at home, right? Like say, you know, your drink will last maybe a week for sure because you've from experience, you know that. So you can make, say, 4 containers, seal them, test one at a week, test one at 10 days or 14 days, and keep going.
Until you get sick.
until you feel like, okay, I should not be testing this anymore. You know? I don't recommend you do this at home, right? Because I don't want anyone to get sick at home and come to Raheem give me
the- Yeah.
But that's essentially what the lab does. They'll tell you, okay, how long do you want to study the shelf life for? You say 6 months or 1 year. And then they'll ask you how many points do you want to check it on, meaning how many different frequent intervals. So you can tell them, all right, test it for 6 months and test 4 intervals. So they can test it at 1 month, at 3 months, 4 months, and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they'll give you a report, like a biochemical, literally a report that tells you, okay, this is only safe for 45 days or 6 or 2 months. Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow, this is definitely not your grandmother's business for sure. Interesting. Okay, so let's move on to what I'm sure is the topic that most people are looking to dive into, which is funding. All right, mm-hmm. So you guys, at least from the outside, looks like you've ramped up relatively quickly in terms of just the business, and then also the underlying assumption there is that there's been funding to support that growth, right? And so from what I know, and you can talk about it, you've done that through a mix of different sorts of, I will call them capital raises, just from my banking background, but you've done grants, you've done crowdfunding. I think you've done some VC funding, I'm not sure. And then you've just had some angel investors too, I think. So do you want to, I'll just leave it open to talk about the various ways you funded it and, you know, what worked, what didn't work from your perspective.
Yeah, so, you know, if you start a business, I would say you need to have a very strong desire to make it succeed beyond just money, because it's never it's never easy. It's always very, very difficult. And we had our mindset on from the beginning, if we had to make one bottle of this thing, sell it and make two, sell those, make three or four, we would do that. And we were prepared for that. We knew it would be difficult, but and it still was not was much more difficult than how difficult it was. You know, for us, especially, you know, immigrants, not just Africans, you know, that come here and most of our family are still back home, our realities are very different. Like, it's very hard for us to save money because they have to send money back home. It's very hard to do so many things because there's all these different pressures. Oh, you should build a house home. You should do this. You should do that. So getting a big amount of savings is quite challenging. So when we launched this business, when we decided we would launch it, by the way, we had been talking about this and thinking about this, how the brand identity would look for a while at that point. When we finally decided we'd launch this, all we had at our disposal was a little less than $1,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's no lie. So we said, okay, is this enough to do anything? My brother, I remember him saying, well, we can register a company.
I was going to say, it sounds to me like you can register a company and that's about it.
All right, that's a start. And I guess I can put my next salary into this. I mean, we can start buying ingredients and playing around with it and we can get going that way. And, you know, some of the advice you hear out there often, I'll go on a tangent a little bit here, because all of the books written, the MBA books, the major university advice, it's amazing advice. It's excellent advice. The only problem is it does not take into account the problems that I just told you about or the challenges of some people who come really from very unique and difficult circumstances. It looks at people who normally maybe graduated from college, one got an amazing job, saved ton of money, or got funding through a friend or family round and such. So meaning around $100,000 to $200,000, got the thing started, had a proof of concept, goes and raises $1 million, and then they go boom. And from there, they go and they raise $10 million. So that's not the reality of most of our people, unfortunately. you know, we can barely come across $50,000, you know, to do anything. So, and that's the reality that came really quickly. When we did the math, we needed $1.5 million to get started.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait.
So what we wanted, yeah, for what we wanted to do, the way we wanted to do it properly, we needed $1.5 million.
Oh, wow. We were like, okay.
I think this is doable.
Wow. Wait. Let's pause. So yeah. So really speaking now to, we have a wide audience, but the people that are going to focus in on this are a lot of African immigrants who have businesses in this space. And just from, by virtue of my experience of talking to a broad range of people, from whether it's service hospitality to actual packaged goods, yeah. I don't think I've ever met or spoken to anyone who did the math before jumping in to know that they needed X number. People usually jump in and then figure it as they go along, and it's like, whoa. So like what, I mean, not without, maybe it's too technical, but how do you arrive at a 1.5 million number for a juice business?
Again, just a side note, if you're listening to this, and you don't do the math before you jump, please do the math before you jump.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.